You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you very much for coming. My name is Chris Rogers. I'm with the Open Society Foundation's Regional Policy Initiative on Afghanistan and Pakistan, and very excited for our event today. We've been working with Sarah Bilal's organization, Justice Project Pakistan, in conjunction with Open Society fellow photographer Asim Rafiqi for much of the past year on the issue of Pakistani detainees being held at the U.S. detention center at Bagram in Afghanistan. It's been a quite multifaceted and ambitious project with a report that we just released over in Pakistan, as well as here in the United States in Washington, D.C., as well as an advocacy campaign connected to a lot of the photographs and information and testimonies that Asim and JPP have collected from family members throughout Pakistan over the last year that are now online and part of an exhibition that was displayed in Islamabad in Washington, D.C. this week. And then we'll go to other cities over the coming months, including Lahore, Peshawar, London, and wherever else they can and we can take it. But today, we're also going to broaden that conversation to broader issues around the impact of war on terror policies and security policies on the people in Pakistan. I think stories and insights and narratives that we get little exposure to here in the United States in particular. We're very excited and pleased to have Shamila Chaudhry with us to moderate today. Shamila is a South Asia Fellow at the New America Foundation with extensive experience in U.S.-Pakistan relations, Pakistani domestic politics, and security. Shamila is currently senior advisor to Vali Nasser at SAIS at Johns Hopkins, and previously has worked for over 12 years in the U.S. government at various posts, including with the National Security Council, as director for Pakistan and Afghanistan, as well as on the Department of State's policy planning staff, where she advised Secretary Clinton and late Ambassador Richard Holbrook on Afghanistan and Pakistan. With that, thank you very much. I will hand it over to Shamila and look forward to the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. It's great to be in New York. I love getting out of Washington and seeing normal faces in the audience and people that wear normal clothes. And if I were in Washington, everyone would be wearing a navy blue suit. So it's nice to be here in this wonderful space as well. So as he mentioned, I do have a bit of experience working on U.S.-Pakistan relations in the U.S. government. And the Pakistan part of my service has been really interesting. I mean, there are two bookends to it that I think are very telling about the kind of the direction that the relationship has taken. I started out on the Pakistan desk in late 2007, and that was just one month into that job, President Musharraf declared a state of emergency. And before that state of emergency was declared, the U.S.-Pakistan relationship was very strong. And I'm doing air quotes here. And what does that mean? It was strong in the sense that any kind of public messaging out of the U.S. government was extremely positive about Musharraf, very flowery. There was a very close relationship, or the perception of a close relationship between President Bush and President Musharraf. And this was very much a centralized relationship at that level. The bureaucracies on both sides didn't really have a lot of engagement or awareness of the policies that were ongoing in the realm of security. And fast forward to 2011, I was working at the National Security Council at the White House and gave my notice to leave the day after the bin Laden raid. And it was just a coincidence. I didn't put in my notice because of the raid, of course, but I sort of knew where it was headed. And at that time, the relationship was completely opposite of what it was in late 2007. So in just a few short 3 years, we had gone from very close cooperation on security, however you want to define that, to the United States having to take a unilateral measure into another sovereign country. A country that, I have to be honest, no one in the U.S. government would think that we could, would have thought we could have done something so unilaterally, because Pakistan was, we weren't in Pakistan like we were in Afghanistan. So it was a very controversial move, completely the opposite than 3 years before. And I think this, this sets us up for the discussion we're going to have today, because it shows you how complex the security issues were between these two, and how, how much things could change so quickly. And it was completely ignorant of the human side of things. In my entire time working on Pakistan, I never once had to work on the detainee issue. And I was working on national security policy for 3 years. This issue never came onto my plate. It was extremely compartmentalized in what was already a compartmentalized relationship. So I think that drives the point home of how important this discussion we're having today is. And we're very lucky to have an extremely dynamic group here today. I come from the national security policy space, so there's my perspective. And we have Sadia Thur, who is an associate professor of sociology and anthropology and social work at the College of Staten Island at the City University of New York. She received her PhD from Cornell University. And in her work, she focuses on issues of culture, nationalism, gender, sexuality, state formation, and international political economy. So we're looking forward to having her remarks. Next to her is Sara Bilal. She's the director of the Justice Project Pakistan and also leads their legal team. So this is our legal expert here. We can send all those questions to her. She studied at Oxford University, and she received her license to practice in Pakistan and gained the rights of audience in the High Court in 2008. And next to her is Asim Rafiqi, who is an Open Society Fellow here and a photojournalist. His work has appeared in numerous publications, including National Geographic, Newsweek, and Time. And his fellowship focuses on the plight of Pakistan's most marginalized, the people that we never hear about when we look at the security issues, and looking at the structural roots of the injustice in the legal system. And he's done quite a bit of work beyond Pakistan, has reported from Haiti, Japan, India, Afghanistan, Israel, Palestine, and so on. So we've got a photojournalist, we have a lawyer, professor of anthropology and sociology, and then I've worked in the government. So so I think this is a very dynamic group, and we're very fortunate to have everyone here. And just a note on process. So what we're going to do is each of the panelists will talk for about 10 minutes, and then I will guide a broader discussion with them about the issues that they've introduced. And probably around 1:30, we'll open up the room for questions. So with that, I'll turn to Sara to begin talking about the report.
Hi, everyone. So I'm going to talk a little bit about who we are at Justice Project Pakistan, and then we're going to talk a little bit about the litigation that we filed and the reasons for filing it, and how successful that was or wasn't, and how that led up to the report and the launch of the campaign. So Justice Project Pakistan, my organization, was founded in December 2009. We're based out of Lahore, and we're a law firm, a nonprofit law firm that represents those prisoners in Pakistan that are facing the harshest punishments and therefore the most vulnerable. And that means we defend people from death row to victims of police torture and Pakistani detainees in the war on terror. JPP, as we're called, we have a dedicated team of investigators whose sole task is to unearth facts about our clients, which is quite a novel concept in Pakistani law, defense-based investigations and defense-based fact gathering. And it's through these in-depth investigations that JPP seeks to gather all the relevant information relating to its clients and advocating on their behalf, not only in a court of law, but in the court of public opinion. So the Bagram litigation came about in 2010, in October 2010, because of the work that another organization, Reprieve, had been doing on, which is an organization based in the United Kingdom, and they had done a lot of work representing Gitmo detainees. And they and their investigators had actually unearthed information about Pakistani detainees that were being held in Bagram. They couldn't find anyone to litigate on their behalf, so they found us. So they presented us with the facts that they had, and we decided to take on the case. When the aims of the litigation were threefold. Firstly, we filed it before the Lahore High Court. So Pakistan has three tiers of courts. You have the regular criminal court, then you have the High Court, and then you have the Supreme Court. And we filed it as public interest litigation on behalf of the 11 families, sorry, at that time there were seven families that we had information about. And we filed it on their behalf as public interest in the Lahore High Court. And the aims of the litigation were threefold. Firstly, we wanted the court to examine the complicity of the Pakistani government in the kidnapping, capture, rendition, transfer of its own citizens to a foreign nation leading up to their indefinite detention at Bagram. And we wanted the court to bring criminal charges against those that would be found guilty of conspiring against their own citizens within the Pakistani government. We also asked the court to compel the Pakistani government to demand the repatriation of its citizens from Bagram back to Pakistan. And the third aim of filing that litigation was actually to bring public attention around this issue, because unlike Guantanamo Bay, that everybody in Pakistan knows about and of the world over, people had no idea about Bagram. And that's considered especially shocking since out of 60 third country nationals, which means non-Afghan detainees at Bagram, 40 of them are Pakistanis. So Pakistanis form the majority of them, and clearly the Pakistani government has a huge role to play in seeing Bagram being shut down or asking for its citizens to be repatriated. When we filed this litigation, we realized quite early on through the experience that we had that this was going to be a case that was not necessarily going to be won in the court of law, but mainly in the court of public opinion. None of the initial judges at the High Court wanted to even touch the case with a 10-foot pole, so they kept on recusing themselves on one excuse or another, and we just couldn't get a hearing. And it was interesting because, we were going in arguing on the law. We thought that the judges were actually just confused about, what they could possibly do about this. And then we learned pretty soon after the fourth judge wasn't interested in hearing about the law that there was something else going on over here. This was more about a political stance that, these judges necessarily just didn't want to get involved in this issue. And it also because they were misconceiving the issue as, taking on the United States, for example. And that was enough to, get them not to come even close to this. In fact, after one of the, I think it was like in front of the third judge, we're walking out of the hearing and the attorney general in the case, the guy from the attorney general's office walked out, and we're mostly a firm, by the way, run by women in Pakistan, so that's also a novelty, right? And he came out and he said, I don't know what you girls are up to, but you can't take on the United States. It's a superpower, So go home and start doing something productive instead of this. And that was really important because I think that made us really realize how, the court and the government was perceiving this litigation, that it was about taking on the United States. And that really actually helped us focus on, rebranding our message. And how that message was going to be sent out in the public sphere and in the court. So what did we do when we weren't getting a hearing? We decided to go on a press blitz because we said, okay, we're going to make our case. If we can't make it in the court, we're going to make it in the public sphere. So we pulled a lot of strings to get onto any TV show that would want to talk about this issue. And we started approaching, a rebranding was about we are holding the Pakistani government accountable for its role in how it has failed its own citizens, either by, rendering them or, being complicit in their capture, or by not taking a step to demand their repatriation. Those are the questions that we were posing before the court. Well, I was on a cooking show talking about Bagram, which is really funny, where I actually had to kind of cook and talk about Bagram, one of those I couldn't do well, which was cooking. But there was a strength to that because the next time we ended up in front of the court, in front of this new judge, you know, he had just heard about, he had seen us on TV. There was an op-ed published in a major newspaper, and there was an editorial in another paper. So we had called it Bagram Week. So he kind of knew the arguments that we were making, and we had our first hearing in the case, and boom, he just went for it. And he gave his first round of orders, which was, you know, he lambasted the Attorney General's office and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and ordered them to go to Bagram and visit their citizens and take stock of who's there and how long they've been there. And that was the beginning of a beautiful year where this guy, I want to show you a picture of the Attorney General before this hearing that we had, because he was just so used to, this is how he went. He was actually in court 5 minutes before our case was called, and I was so upset, I was so angry at him that I actually took a picture of him in court, which could get me into a lot of trouble, but this was the last time he slept in court. Before our case was called. Now it's a reverse. And, you know, in December 2000, so in October he passed this order that the Pakistani government must go and visit its citizens. In February, our judge then passed another order saying that based on the accounts provided by the Pakistani government, coming from the mouths of the detainees, as well as, you know, whatever the United States government has been telling the Pakistanis, he finds that there are no substantial charges to be holding these citizens without trial and without charge, and that the Pakistani government is obligated to demand the repatriation of these guys. And that was a pretty strong order that he, you know, it was a detailed order that he came, that he wrote in respect of each detainee, weighing the facts on each side. Since then, every month, the Pakistani government has to turn up in court and answer to the court about what they have done to push the negotiations further. And the litigation has been a great way of kind of exerting pressure on the Pakistani government to force them to start negotiating with the Americans to start the process of repatriation. However, you know, in that background, around 2011, 2012, the wind down of, you know, the U.S. operations in Afghanistan was started to be talked about. And there was motivation on the part of the U.S. government to start releasing some of these guys. So the litigation, again, proved as a good linchpin on which, you know, you could keep the Pakistani government motivated to keep the process moving, a process that they otherwise were really not interested in, as you can see. But I want to talk, I also want to, and you know, the last big hearing that we had was last year in July when the Director General of the Afghan desk at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs was called back, was called to Lahore to appear in front of the court, and he was outraged for even making that 4-hour trip and to be asked to answer for his role and, you know, what he was doing. And that caused the government then to change their tactics. Our judge was called in by the Chief Justice of the Lahore High Court and personally asked to drop the case. And, you know, God bless him. Yeah, he told the Chief Justice, no, it's not going to happen. He was then threatened to be, you know, sent off to Multan or to lose his comfy seat in Lahore and would be punished for not, you know, letting go of the case. And he didn't. He was sent off to Multan for a little while, but he's back in October and we're going back to court. The government also started releasing information to journalists and other anchor people in the news, which was entirely false. And it was meant to demonize these people that we were representing. They also started pressurizing the families of the detainees and saying, if you want us to help you get these guys back, stop going to court. I think Asim is going to talk more about what it's like, and I've been told I'm out of time. But what I want to say is that, you know, what led up to us writing the report was that we realized that there was an opportunity now to not only explain to both governments what this you know, supposedly very complicated process of repatriations is, and to give our recommendations on how to speed it up. But also what was essentially missing from any discussion about these guys were who they were. You know, they have no voice. They have no access to lawyers. They're my clients for the last 3 years. I can't speak to them. They're not allowed to speak about the conditions of their detentions, the condition of their capture, and their treatment, or any of that with their families or, you know, through their letters, which are heavily censored. So there's no way for them to get their side of the story. You know, the only story that we have is of the United States government and the Pakistani government, who they are. And that story is deeply, deeply flawed. And the whole point behind writing this report and launching this campaign was we want to fight back on that. You know, there has been plenty of discussion over the last 13 years about whether that detention is legal or not legal, or, you know, all of that. And I call it a legal rabbit hole. And as a lawyer, I'm here to tell you that I'm not going to talk about the legalities of that discussion of, you know, that detention, because I think that debate has been rehashed and perfected from either sides, and it has nothing more to contribute. What I do want to talk about is who these people are, the nature of the charges against them, if there are any, and the nature of the evidence against them, and what they're being held for. And that's what the aim of the report and the campaign is. You can fill in for that.
It's always a little bit difficult for a photographer to sit on some of these very sophisticated, rigorous panels and know what to say. But I will talk to you a little bit about what the work is and where we, how we ended up doing this work. But I wanted to start with a few anecdotes and talk a little bit about where the work comes from and what are the things that, as a photographer and someone working in Pakistan, one is confronting. So a couple of weeks, was it about a couple of weeks ago when we were in Islamabad?
Mm-hmm.
So about a couple of weeks ago we did...
Just one week ago.
We did a similar... we did an exhibition in Islamabad of these photographs. And we got in touch with some of the press in Islamabad, including the international press, and we invited some reporters to come and meet with some of the detainee families that were invited to join us at the event in Islamabad. And there were some interesting things that happened which struck me. Of course, I was aware of these, but it was interesting to watch them sort of unfold in front of you. So we had a journalist from a major American newspaper arrive and sit down with some of these detainee families and attempt to interview them. And it was incredible to watch the discomfort and sort of the incomprehension with which he confronted these families. There was this kind of a distance, a coldness and aloofness that he just wasn't able to transcend. The entire interview, the entire conversation with these people who had traveled from quite far away which was rather stunted. And the worst part is that this gentleman, this journalist actually, is Pakistani. He wasn't an American. He was a local journalist working with an American publication. The following day, we had a gallery event, and we invited certain people from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Pakistani Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and a lovely gentleman in a fine suit and Italian boots turned up. And the families, again, were, of course, at this event, and we had about five or six families, some from rural Punjab. We had a family that traveled from near the border of Afghanistan. It takes them 6 hours by car to arrive in Muslimbag, and then they flew down to Islamabad, and they were there. And we saw this yet again. There was this gentleman was incredibly uncomfortable and unable to hold a simple, civilized human conversation with a bunch of his own fellow countrymen. And it struck me that it was incredible to the degree to which these people, the prisoners who and their families, who, by the way, all consistently come from some of the most marginal, poor segments of Pakistani society. This has been the one consistent thing that you can see. It was incredible to see how opaque they were to the media and how opaque they were to the representatives of the government that were expected to go and fight on their behalf and somehow represent them. You could just see this incredible divide. And I think that that's one of the unspoken issues, and perhaps it needs to be spoken about more, and I know that there are people who are speaking about more, but certainly we don't speak about it in Pakistan, that this distance, which is very evident to me, is one of the reasons why the injustices that have taken place against these people have been allowed to stand for so long and for so many. Not just, you know, we can sit, I can sit lambast the Americans, what have you, but certainly to hold the Pakistanis to task for the inability to actually find ways to communicate, link, and express and understand what the detention of these men has meant to the men themselves, of course, but to their families. Now, speaking as a photographer, and I speak as an American photographer, because I always call myself an American photographer, at a parallel, I find it amazing that in the last 13, 14 years, not a single major photojournalist has actually done a major piece of work on the victims of the war against terror. Now, whether that's in the United States of America, whether that's about the immigration sweeps that took place post 9/11 and the thousands that were picked up and the families that were separated, the deportations, whether it was the communities that were put under deep surveillance, whether it was the CIA entrapment programs using collaborators, whether it was the victims of the wars that we've unleashed, the millions displaced, and one could go on, whether it's the men or women coming out, men, or I don't know how many women came out, coming out of Bagram or Guantanamo, there actually isn't a body of work, given the scope, the scale, the intensity of what has transpired here post 9/11, a body of photographic documentary work that does justice to what has actually happened, whether it's in Iraq or Afghanistan or Pakistan. And now, again, as I said, I'm speaking here as a photographer, and that, for me, is not only shocking, it's actually quite shameful. And the same state of affairs stands even in Pakistan. I mean, we've had sporadic works, of course, that, you know, photographers have gone out to some refugee camps, or you'll see a story here and there. But if I look across the field of all our great major photographers and what have you, you really actually see nothing. Certainly nothing that does, as I said, that reflects the scope and scale of what has transpired here. And in fact, you're more likely to find photographers working on projects about the victims of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan than people really documenting the consequences of the American presence in Afghanistan. And this is a question that I've asked repeatedly amongst my colleagues and my peers, and I frankly don't have a very good answer for this. Now, the reason why I bring that up, and I just want to quote something that Glenn Greenwald wrote some years ago. The reason why I bring that up, and that will bring me into the issue of how I'm working. So I'm quoting from a piece that Greenwald wrote where he argued that there are many factors accounting for the willingness to tolerate or even approve of this systemic persecution. But one important reason that is that the victims of these endless wars, what have you, by design, are so rarely heard from. So as is true for most groups of humans who remain hidden, they are therefore easily demonized. And this invisibility also means that even those who object in principle to what is being done have difficulty apprehending in a visceral way the devastation that is wreaked in the lives of these human beings who have done nothing wrong. Now, the absence from our discourse can confine one's understanding of these issues to the theoretical realm and thus limit one's ability to truly care. And that's the fundamental reality that we're dealing with here about any one of these situations. And if you, and that's basically what my work, I've been a fellow with Soros, I've been a Soros fellow since last year. And my project is broadly about the issues and questions of justice in Pakistan, looking at the segments of society that actually are not in the interest of the judicial legal system of Pakistan. They sort of fall outside of it. And also very much what the meaning of justice is, particularly issues of social justice, for which millions in Pakistan are actually struggling every day to achieve, but that seemed to be, again, invisible from the rhetoric, the discourse of the mainstream, of the mainstream media and the politicians. And that's what my work is trying to challenge the master narratives by which Pakistan is defined. Now, we hear a lot about Pakistanis talking about, well, you know, the West represents us in a certain way. We are a failed state. We're on the brink and all that stuff. But I think more egregiously, the Pakistanis themselves represent themselves in the same way. We ourselves have not been able to develop narratives, particularly individual narratives that challenge these broader master narratives of war against terror or globalization or human rights, which, by the way, is another meta-narrative that is being questioned through my particular work. And Bagram is one very specific example of that. This is perhaps an example. This is sort of what I'm trying to do here is construct a full understanding of who these men are in this prison and what has happened. What are their histories, their backgrounds, their childhoods? How do they end up in Afghanistan, if at all, is that that's where they were picked up? And more importantly, what has happened to the rest of their families? I mean, I have a daughter, and I know what would happen to me if someone disappeared her and left her in indefinite detention in a prison across the border. So I need to travel, and I go meet these mothers and the brothers, and you see the devastation. You see entire families that have been crippled brutally. This is not an esoteric, theoretical question. I've met mothers who have gone mad. They're mentally unable to comprehend life. I've met brothers who are considering suicide because they haven't seen their brothers in 11 years. I mean, this whole process has wrecked lives. So we have 40-odd Pakistani men in prison, but you have hundreds of people who are falling apart outside. And they travel far and wide to try and speak to the press, they try and speak to members of the Foreign Affairs Committee, and they see people to whom they are opaque. And this work is just trying to cut past a little bit of that opaqueness, to try and get us to understand that we are actually talking not about master narratives or wars or laws, but we are talking about individual history. So, thank you.
Thank you so much, Sara and Asim and Shmaila, and thanks to the Open Society for holding this very important event and for including me in this. And I want to actually just tag on to the stuff that Asim was talking about. And I'm going to speak from the perspective of somebody who has been doing political work here around the war in Afghanistan, and then increasingly from 2008, 2009 onwards around the then secret war in Pakistan and now not so secret war in Pakistan. And the issues that we faced here reflect the same kind of the absence, the dehumanization of the people, the actual people who are suffering as a consequence of this incredibly long war. And that absence comes, of course, from the dehumanization comes from the absence of their narratives, but that's not just a coincidence. It's incredibly hard to get their stories or a story that's outside the existing frames within which the media here wants to understand Pakistan into the press. And I'm not just talking about the mainstream press. I mean, the New York Times obviously has a very particular perspective. We don't expect the New York Times to listen to our side or to pay attention to what we're saying. But I'm very sorry to say that it has been extraordinarily difficult and impossible, actually, to get through to the nation, even Democracy Now. And so I think it's really spaces like this, these kinds of events that we have had to turn to, and it's not, have to turn to doesn't mean that we don't want to do this, but these are limited in some sense in scope. I mean, what the nation can, the audience of the nation can reach out to is, by definition, a much larger audience. And so we've had our work really cut out for us, and that's, I think, also where the kind of work that you people are doing, the report that you have produced, the campaign that you have started, is so immensely useful for us because, we're working on the court of public opinion here, right? And of course, and we can talk, I think, in Q&A about what is happening in Pakistan in terms of this disconnect and the ways in which who it is that does not want to address this issue of the war in Pakistan as well, right? So, it's just a very sort of visceral example of what that this dehumanization means is that when we had these series of natural disasters in Pakistan, one that earthquake in 2005, and then those incredible floods in 2010, the UN had an incredibly difficult time meeting its goals for financial support to Pakistan, and analysts talked in mainstream newspapers about the empathy deficit that Pakistan had, because not surprisingly, people seem to think that Pakistan is just crawling with these Islamic fundamentalists, right? There are no ordinary people in Pakistan. There's nobody who suffers. There's just evil, bearded people who are anti-American and therefore, anti-everything good and progressive, right? So this is a wonderful and very, you know, beautifully orchestrated kind of feedback loop, right? And so these are the moments in which we get to hopefully interrupt it. So I was, you know, asked to sort of talk a little bit about the impact of the war on terror on Pakistan, and you guys are actually probably much better placed to do that since you actually met the people directly impacted. But let me talk very briefly about that. I mean, there's different layers and levels of that impact. One is, of course, this very direct impact on people who are disappeared and detained and who have actually also lost their lives, who are tortured. There are, of course, thanks to reports by Reprieve and then the Stanford and Columbia reports on the drone attacks in Pakistan, we know about the families that are devastated in the Waziristan region. We know that over 200 children have died, and that the normal life is really a dream in those areas. Everybody, including the children, is suffering from PTSD, right? And this is something that you see repeated wherever there are drone strikes. I think there's a recent article about what's happening in Yemen, and there's a child psychologist talking about basically the same kinds of things. So imagine living, you know, if you can, under those circumstances. And then we can imagine how it is that even some Pakistanis can't, living in Pakistan, put themselves in that place. And then that makes them take certain positions that gel very neatly with liberal opinion in the US on Pakistan. So there's that direct human impact, and that, you know, that's directly also connected to the war on terror. And of course, the Pakistani state agencies, the military, the ISI are very deeply implicated in that. So it's not that we want to leave them off the hook, but the fact that it's happening under this particular kind of secret and long-standing, you know, military operation is really something that we need to think about. Then, of course, there's the indirect or structural sort of fallout of this now, 12-year war, in terms of the way in which it has strengthened all the right-wing forces in Pakistan, from the military, the intelligence agencies, the scary, you know, Islamic militant outfits, you name it, right? And of course, the US has, in some cases, explicitly supported these forces, such as, of course, the military dictatorship of Pervez Musharraf. When there was a huge popular uprising against Musharraf after the emergency, the US ambassador was busy trying to do backroom, you know, deals with the lawyers' movement, asking them to sort of back down and let Musharraf be, because they saw Musharraf as their natural ally. And of course, this is also a pattern that the US has in terms of its foreign policy: much rather deal with dictators, because you know that the people on the ground are not going to support what you're doing. So there's that. Then, of course, there's other areas which we don't directly connect with the war on terror, but are deeply connected, such as what is happening in Balochistan, and has been happening in Balochistan over the last 10, 20 odd years in particular. I mean, the issue of Balochistan is much bigger than the last 10 or 20 years, but there are ways in which the war on terror has really, really exacerbated the problems there. You have enforced disappearances there that have nothing to do directly with the war on terror, but the war on terror has provided a very convenient cover for the Pakistani state to engage in all these shady sort of actions. And then, of course, it has also very conveniently kind of replaced the secular nationalist organizations in Balochistan with these Islamic militant outfits that it feels it has more control over. And it did that explicitly to subvert the nationalist movement in Balochistan, right? And so that also don't necessarily connect it to the war on terror, but it is in many different kinds of ways completely connected to it. But even that isn't enough if you want to really understand the full impact what we need to do is try and understand the impact of the US relationship with Pakistan, not just over the last 10 years or the last 20 years, or even, you know, at most our memories go back to the 80s and the proxy war with Afghanistan. You know, everybody after Charlie Wilson's war could tell you that, oh yes, we did, you know, such bad things, and oh dear, we seem to have, you know, let loose all these ideologies that now are so troublesome to us. Well, you know, they're not just troublesome to you. They're really deeply troublesome to Pakistanis, because in that period, the Afghan war's devastation, of course, what the Afghan war did to Afghanistan is there, but what the Afghan war did to Pakistan is something that nobody knows about and nobody really cares about. But what the Afghan war did to Pakistan was, again, shore up a really, really horrible military dictatorship, Zia-ul Haq, that was trying to re-engineer Pakistani society because it had moved way too far to the left for the comfort of the right-wing forces in Pakistan and for the US's comfort, right? And so it was all about infusing that same, you know, what we call jihadi ideology into Pakistan itself. Then the fact that there was a gun culture, gun proliferation, therefore, you know, incredible increase in violence in everyday life in Pakistan. There was the rise of a drug culture because of the heroin that came in. And so, you know, even, I mean, I think Tariq Ali has really talked about this very well in several of his books, about how the social fabric of this country was completely, you know, devastated by that one war. And then, of course, really what we need to look at is go even further to the whole of the Pakistani relationship with the US. And next year, we will celebrate 60 years of this relationship. In April 1954, Pakistan and the US signed the first of many Cold War alliances, the Mutual Defense and Security Pact. And that, of course, was the beginning of Pakistan's collapse in, as a society in terms of the takeover of the military, right? And that was also very much something that the US supported at that time. So if we really want to understand what is happening in Pakistan, and, you know, it always amazes me that the most well-meaning and well-read people in the US will, when confronted with the obvious anger that some Pakistanis feel, are completely taken aback. They just don't understand it. And then the frames and the modes that are given to you through the media to understand that is that they must be crazy, right? They're just all conspiracy theorists. Well, I mean, imagine living in a society when there is an actual conspiracy happening every second, right? You have CIA operatives running loose in one of the major cities of the country, driving, you know, fancy cars full speed down the wrong way on a one-way street and shooting at people.
Yeah.
You probably have not heard of Raymond Davis, right? Then the US tried very hard to cut him loose. No, nothing to see here. Don't know him, right? And then he was magically whisked back to the US, where he was, I think, caught on assault and battery charges. Because he ruined someone's car in a parking lot, like road rage, right? Clearly this guy had road rage, but... but anyway, I mean, I think that's, for now, all I really need to say, and then we can pick up on many of these themes in Q&A and with the discussion with Shumaila. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This is exactly the note I wanted to end on, because
we planned this.
Raymond Davis. I hate Raymond Davis. He took up so much time in our office of, like, you know, hours and hours, late nights, working on this big problem. I think a lot of, there are Americans that do know him quite well, unfortunately, and I am glad that you brought it up, because you know, my own experience of working on the U.S.-Pakistan relationship and dealing a lot, you know, my own family is from Pakistan, but I grew up in the States, and working on the relationship in the U.S. government, I had a very unique kind of vantage point and set of experiences, but I would be on the other side of the table from Pakistanis who would be, you know, expressing all of these concerns, and I would have to listen to my colleagues, you know, say these are all conspiracy theories and, oh, they're so crazy. And so I have heard these comments, and it's true. These are very real perceptions. But I think, you know, we have to take a step back. There's a lot of emotion in the relationship, and that's part of the problem. It's clouded perspectives on both sides. And once I started to take a step back, what I noticed was that this is a very important relationship for both sides that has no formalized structures existing between it, okay? So, for example, the United States would give Pakistan money that's called coalition support funds, right? This is part of the war on terror kind of commitment, and this money would go to various activities. You know, this was given to the military and for various activities that were undocumented. No one knew how this money was spent. There were never any receipts United States, during the time of Musharraf, would ask for receipts or details on how this money was spent. Both sides, just no questions asked, right? Other countries do get coalition support funds. So, for example, Egypt got them since the Camp David Accords, but they had the Camp David Accords. That's what that was the tie that bound them together, okay? And you know, Israel was part of that. Pakistan and the United States never had that. They still don't have it, right? What they had was a gentleman's agreement between President Musharraf and President Bush. And when those governments transitioned out, two very different set of governments came in, and I think they were burdened by the fact that there was nothing on paper. There was no documentation for what this relationship was supposed to be about at the political level. At the level of intelligence and the relationships between the intelligence agencies, I think that was a very convenient situation for them because they wouldn't have to deal with the questions of where are all these people going? You know, what's your process for dealing with the detainees? So I think it was a very convenient situation for intel agencies on both sides, which, in my opinion, really drive this relationship. That is the core of this relationship. When you work on the, you know, when you work in the U.S. government on Pakistan, you very quickly realize who the drivers are on both sides, and that's an unfortunate reality. And I think these issues just get ignored for the most part. One kind of funny experience I have is before I was working on Pakistan, I was working on Indonesia and humanitarian assistance, and I felt so great going to work every day because we're helping people. And when I went to the Pakistan desk, you know, I would learn about what was going on in the New York Times. And I would think, of course this is not true. I mean, I would know about it, right, if it was true. And of course I was wrong. You know, I mean, that's very naive. I was very young when I started. But I tell people that because I want people to understand that on the U.S. side, too, there are lots and lots of layers of people not knowing things. I think the problems are on both sides. I have a few comments and questions that I'm going to throw out there to the three of you, and then I'd like you to just unpack some of those ideas that I know you didn't get a chance to talk about. One thing that all of you mentioned actually was the Pakistani government being complicit at a certain level. And Sara, you started out by talking about how you couldn't get support from the courts and the judges, and then then you found some support, but at some point the government turned on you guys and you lost it. And so I'd like to know from you, like, how much of that did you sense was from Pakistani government pressure and not fear of kind of going up against the United States? Because I want to challenge that a little bit, because I think the U.S. is a very convenient and logical excuse to put out there. Excuse is probably not the right word, because the U.S. does get involved in Pakistan's domestic politics. It has a very bad history of doing that. But it's not just the U.S. in this case. And so I'd like it if you could talk about kind of how the Pakistani government's involvement stalled some of the work that you wanted to do and why. And on this area in particular, because Pakistani government does have a history of missing persons before 9/11. So what's different, right? So talk about that a little bit. And then Asim said something really interesting. He was talking about the victims of the war on terror. And in some ways, I feel like, people who live in countries like the United States or that have also experienced attacks, or we're all victims of the war on terror, right? I mean, we have our own kind of first world problems that we have to deal with that we don't like. I get so annoyed when I hear people complaining about the security at the airport. And from my perspective, I think if you only knew, you would not complain about this. But there's that perspective. When you said victims, you described all these detainees and their families, and I can understand their families, but I think could be some debate on the detainees and if they're actually innocent or not. And I know there's a legal term for being innocent, but when I read the narratives of some of these folks, I do have there are a lot of gaps for me, from my perspective, my experience of why they were in this area, what they were doing. I think other people might have those questions too, if you're working from the national security perspective. So I'd like to know, your view, your take on this. I mean, I'm sure it's come up. And then finally for Sadia, this is, I think this is actually the most interesting, and it's going to be a longer term issue, is You mentioned that you couldn't get the attention of fairly kind of left of center organizations to talk about these issues. And the other thing I've seen in working on the U.S.-Pakistan relationship is there is no organic kind of public constituency for this relationship in the United States. You have the military and the Department of Defense guys who have their own vested interests, and the Pakistani military on the other side. But it's not like, you know, there's such a large diaspora here that's pushing some of these social issues, right? There's a fair amount of schizophrenia, I think, in that community anyway on the politics. Why do you think that's the case? I mean, that's my view, but why do you think that there's, these organizations, for example, I mean, is it self-censorship? You mentioned kind of the Nation and Democracy Now.
Oh.
I mean, just kind of elaborate a little bit on that. My own take is that there's no kind of public constituency for this. And even when I remember we used to go up to Congress and ask them to members and staffers to, let's give more money for the floods. We need more money. No one would do it because they don't have anyone calling them complaining about it, you know, and saying this is a big issue, right? So there's, on one aspect, there's a very natural thing happening, right? On the other hand, I think there is a political dynamic that we haven't really addressed yet. And it could be self-censorship, but it could be something else. So
we didn't have Sean Penn.
Yeah.
Go up down to Haiti. That's what we needed.
We needed Angelina. We did have Angelina.
And then one final question for all of you. Can you tell me what you actually think the national security threat is coming out of Pakistan, both for Pakistanis and for, say, Americans or other kind of Western nations? What is the real threat?
Great. Should I begin with the first question?
Sure. Please, anyone.
I wasn't quite sure exactly what you were asking, so I'm going to answer it to the best of my knowledge. But if I'm not answering what you asked, please do interrupt. I think the Pakistani government's reaction to these guys, to the Bagram detainees in particular, is that they're just not their problem. And as far as their complicity is concerned, I think the practice of rendition that's much more that's better documented and that was much more common pre-Obama. Those guys are already in Guantanamo. Some of them have been released. A lot of them are still there. So I think the Bagram group that you're talking about are different people. They have different stories about how they got there as well. I can tell you about a bunch of juveniles that have been there, that are still there, that were captured. Whether it was in Afghanistan or in Pakistan is unclear. We've compiled their histories, from when they disappeared from Pakistan. And for example, I'll give the story of Saifullah and Hamidullah, actually, both of them. Their families were displaced during the floods. And, during the Sawat operation, they moved down to Karachi from Waziristan. Their parents were incredibly poor, working as laborers, as security guards. For Hamidullah, his father sent him back to go and collect, their family's belongings to bring them back. And, Hamidullah went with a friend on a bus during his school holidays. He was 14, wanted to be a doctor. His friend got off halfway through where, he needed to get off. And then Hamidullah went and stayed with his grandparents in the area where his parents were, and was then last seen boarding a bus back to come to Karachi. He was 14 years old at that time. His parents didn't know where he was for 2 years until an ex-detainee, they thought he was dead. His father, who's incredibly poor, spent all the money that they had for 2 years going to every single police station, from the top of Pakistan, down to Karachi. Trying to find out where his son is, and thought that he had died until an ex-detainee who was released came back and informed their family that your child is actually there. Coming back to this, this just goes a little bit to the question of who these people are and how they get to be there. The Pakistani government does not really view them necessarily as people that have committed crimes against the state, because the Pakistani government themselves has not seen any evidence from the Americans, who have refused to share any classified evidence on these guys. And in the absence of that, they really don't have much to go on. The ones that they have been complicit in, there's some very well-publicized cases of people that have been picked up by the Pakistani authorities, handed over to the Americans, you know, rendered to, I call it the rendition tour, you know, to the Middle East, North Africa, you know, then Bagram, then Guantanamo Bay. And, you know, it has come out publicly that the Pakistanis were involved in picking them up at the behest of the Americans and the British, you know, and interrogating them. There's also complicity in the sense of, you know, in the legal sense, what we've argued in court is that there's different levels of complicity. So, you know, there is the legal notion of being mixed up in the wrongdoing, which is a notion that's been recognized in the British courts for one of the detainees from Bagram. And that concept basically says that, you know, if the Americans have picked someone up, and, you know, a Pakistani citizen up, even in, you know, Afghanistan, and then they reach out to the Pakistanis to confirm his nationality or to, you know, find out who he is, you know, they call up the Ministry of Interior, you know, get us some facts about this guy or his background. If the Ministry of Interior complies with the request that then leads to that detainee's detention in a place like Bagram, then the Pakistani government is complicit. They're mixed up in the wrongdoing, and that constitutes a violation. And that's what we've argued in front of the Pakistani court as well. So we're looking at all levels of the complicity that they have.
Okay, I'm just going to touch on the 2 points. Sorry, go ahead.
One other thing. We'll come back to this. But in terms of, you know, the Pakistani government interning their own people, the AACP regulations were passed when, Chris?
2011, July.
2011. And they're a piece of art because we learned that from the Americans and the Patriot Act. They've literally copied and pasted a bunch of provisions. You know, so we learned this from the Americans, and we continue to learn, you know, how to draft our counterterrorism laws and policies that are now used to intern thousands of Pakistanis that have come straight from, you know, the American experience of fighting the war on terror. So that was about us interning our own.
So Shamil, just I'm just going to repeat as I understand your question, but if I have misunderstood your question, just please interrupt me. You made 2 points, one about the fact that we are all victims of the war against terror in different ways, I believe. I just want to be very, so I'll be very clear on that. So I think equivalence between my inconvenience and having my bag checked at the airport with a family who's had a family member killed or detained at Guantanamo is a huge mistake. Right. So yes.
But what I meant to say is that I mean there will be different kind of definitions of the
sure,
term victim.
But I think
and
it's important.
The way that you had described it was, you know, very unique, I felt like, and I wanted you to go into kind of...
Yes, and
a lot of people in the U.S. government wouldn't call those people victims, you know?
Again, as I said, I'm a photographer, and I don't really care what the U.S. government would call them, let's be honest. I'm sitting and speaking as an individual. I'm speaking about real victims, lives destroyed, people killed, murdered, detained, displaced, devastated. That, to me, is victimhood. Inconvenience, not really that interested, because we deal with that, I deal with that as an American... So for me, it becomes important about where the stress should lie, and equivalence is something that I don't support. Whether as a reporter or a photographer, that's something I would discourage. I think this balance equivalence thing gets us into a lot of trouble. You also mentioned that there are gaps in the stories of the detainees and the families. I think what I find, and this question was raised by Mr. William Lietzau, who turned up yesterday at our event. This is a gentleman who, I believe, formulated the detention policies for the Bush administration. Chris?
Chris?
No.
You should just come up here.
I'm asking Chris because you know the... Just to...
He was in charge of U.S. detention policy under Bush and
right.
Obama.
And he was very... generous and kind enough to turn up at our
curious.
Event yesterday, curious to turn up at event yesterday, and he made the same argument. And I think what surprises me in this question, is that these questions are being asked of some of the weakest, poorest individuals that we know, and they're not being asked of the United States government. I'm surprised that we're not pushing 50 times harder against a power that is defining our discourse about detentions and these people being terrorists, and these people being Al-Qaeda, but are more willing to ask a guy who breaks bricks for a living in remote Balochistan that he somehow has to counter the government's narrative, which is based on secret evidence, which is based on sloppy, by the way, detainee review board files. I'm sorry, but
Austin, do you think actually that has started to, Americans have started to challenge that,
no.
though?
I have, the, I have, I have an 11, sorry, let me just finish.
Just the,
I have an 11-year-old detainee review board file of a prisoner called Amanatullah Ali, where this process has not even been able to correct the fact that they're accusing a Shia man of belonging to an anti-Shia sectarian organization. 11 years of detention in a detainee review board file, how intellectually rigorous is this process that they couldn't be bothered to just walk down to Punjab where we can go and find out that this doesn't even make sense? So I would like to say, I agree with you that there are gaps in the narrative, but I would say there are larger gaps. There's a bigger onus on a power that is incarcerating without evidence, which is incarcerating in a bizarre military tribunal, not even a really a military tribunal process. And our job, certainly my job as a reporter, as a journalist, as a photographer, as a citizen of America, is to challenge that narrative first and then worry about what these gaps are.
No, and I appreciate that perspective. And I think, I mean, my own view is that the, you know, within kind of the American policy community, the, for example, the use of drones, that particular policy has been challenged for a few years now internally, and it's starting to bubble up into the public space amongst civil society organizations. There's a fair amount of internal debate and argument between senior American policymakers over kind of this drone policy is basically intellectually lazy. We can't say we have no other alternative.
Sure.
This isn't right, right? So then if, you know, given the circumstances on the ground, what do we do? And at some point it was very clear to everyone that the Americans were not, you know, using these strikes to get high-level targets. There were all these other groups of people that were getting lumped into this kind of target definition, right? And there was an internal discussion which, you know, arose and challenged that and forced, you know, the people that were making these decisions, how do you define militant? I want to know, because we've never had this conversation before. It's been how many years since September 11th, and we have never defined that. And when you don't do that, you know, all these different actors start to take liberties, right, with the policy. And so, I mean, I have to say that there was an internal debate, and it's
right.
still going on, but it's not, it's happening internally, but it's not happening at all
yeah.
these other levels.
There,
so with the American
yeah.
people, it's not happening,
sure.
and between the Pakistanis and the Americans, that's still
yeah.
very much
I'd like
as
to
well.
Just jump in and say that, you know, because of the fine folks at Open Society, I've had the opportunity to meet people in the last 2-3 days from State Department, you know, Senate, House, Congress. In fact, I got really confused by all the buildings. But by the way, internally, Congress and Senate looks exactly the same to me, so I never know who I'm in front of. You know, we were talking to all these people who are involved in policy around this issue, and not a single person asked me who these guys were. Until the very end, until the last meeting, the sixth meeting we had, one guy said, who are these people, by the way? And I said, thank you. That is a question that we need to ask. That's a question that I would love to answer for you. You know, I don't see that discussion happening within the United States government. I don't see questions of their innocence even being raised. Because, you know, frankly, as a lawyer or even a human rights activist, they don't have anything to back that up. They don't. We haven't seen any of it. You know, he told you, Asim just told you a very simple story of, you know, mixing up a Shia, you know, as a Lashkar-e-Taiba member. I'll tell you that Iftikhar, you'll see his wife's testimony here in a picture here, you know, he's mentally ill. And I have said this to the United States government, you know, to Dasti Li Zhao. You know, he's mentally ill. We've got his community, we've got his doctors, we've got his family members to testify that he's mentally ill. You're accusing him of being an IED manufacturer. There is not a single terrorist that I know. I mean, the guy can't even count. I mean, he's not going to be able to make anything. He was working on a waterboarding project as a laborer because he couldn't get a job for 23 years. So, but I don't find anybody in the United States government willing or, you know, even the slightest bit receptive to any discussion about their innocence. And I don't understand how they're making these judgment calls, you know, and where this narrative, fact-based narrative, is coming out of, because we've got facts to challenge that. I mean, when we first filed this in court, the U.S. government, through their Pakistani counterparts, came and gave a story of each detainee's capture. And for Saifullah, who disappeared from Karachi, and there's an eyewitness that saw him being kidnapped. You know, that eyewitness is another child who will never come forward because, you know, he's scared for his life. Saifullah dropped his father off at the hospital because his father has severe kidney problems, said, I'm going to go and get medicine, and then was never seen again. His father was left waiting for him for 2 days at the hospital. He never returned. The American account is that he was picked up, you know, in Khos province, which is, you know, on the other side of Afghanistan, you know, in, I think they said 2006. And that's what they said in court. We've got letters from Saifullah, from Bagram, sent through the ICRC that date back to 2004, that predate 2 years of his capture. So it's not only us challenging these facts, but, you know, even the Pakistani court said, this is ridiculous. You have nothing to hold them on, you know, and they're getting it wrong all the time. So, you know, I don't think there's enough pushback on these facts, and I challenge all the facts that the U.S. government has on these guys, because I've never seen them.
Well, one of the internal tensions has always been, you know, I was just going to make a quick comment on kind of what the facts and where the information comes from. And one of the internal challenges has always been, it's not just for the U.S. government, it's for other governments as well, is the kind of the quality of the intelligence and the quality of the information that's being collected. And it is true that a lot of kind of personal rivalries and like people that want to get back at each other, like this gets wrapped up into like reporting on a nefarious person. And it's very common thing that I think we come to expect now. But intelligence is not fact, right? I mean, you have intelligence, it's collected, it's often shared with partners, other countries, to help shape views. And at the end, you have a very imperfect conclusion, right? And take that, I would say, and this is just my observation, we have that, take that combined with the fact that there's an active kind of conflict going on, there's a war going on, and there are people in the battlefield. I think it has made it very difficult for the U.S. government to actually have a public discussion about some of these things. And frankly, I mean, I've worked on these issues. Some of them are never going to be public. I don't think the Pakistani government wants anybody to know that they're collaborating with the United States on intelligence information sharing.
That's too late, right? Because everyone knows they are. Musharraf has been boasting about it.
They are and they aren't is the thing, right? So, I mean, we're in this very gray space, and I think it's very hard to say things like they're not sharing or they are sharing. They are doing it when they want to, and they're not doing it when they don't want to, right? So, I mean, you have a little bit of both. So, it really isn't that black and white, I think.
But what is not black and white?
You're saying everything at once. You're saying that the Pakistani government is complicit, and you're saying it's all the United States' fault, right? And there are quotes, actually, in the report which are very interesting. Go ahead, please.
Okay, sorry. I think that actually your remarks were beautiful because they captured exactly what we are up against once we start to talk about the effect of the war on terror on real, ordinary Pakistanis. And once we start to talk about how this is not even just about the war on terror, because instantly that becomes about, oh, but there is a national security threat, right? That's why I was so careful to say that this is about a relationship that has gone on for 60 years now. And that's a relationship that has produced all the problems that everybody loves to point out in Pakistan. It has supported, directly and indirectly, incredibly anti-people, reactionary right-wing forces in Pakistan, particularly the Pakistani military and the intelligence, but through them, all manner of other kinds of forces, right? No one here, I think, wants to say this is just the US's fault. We're talking about the Pakistani state's complicity. But that, of course, instantly then the conversation shifts to, then let's talk about the complicity of the Pakistani government, because apparently nobody's talking about that. Yeah. Apparently you never read that in the US media. Apparently you never read that in, you know, even Pakistani newspapers. That's such a shock. Let's talk about that, right? And let's talk about why it is that, you know, even left of center media houses are not interested in these stories, because there's no Pakistani diaspora that pushes for it. So that's how people make decisions in these kinds of, especially places like The Nation and Democracy Now. That's how they make decisions about how to pitch a story, which stories to pitch, because there's a diaspora that wants it? I don't think so, right? So I think, in fact, this is precisely why you see the kinds of stories you see in the media, because most people think this way, that this is happening because there is a problem with Pakistan. And there is not just a problem with the Pakistani state and the Pakistani government, there's a problem with the Pakistani people. They are strange, they behave suspiciously, and therefore they must have done something wrong. And therefore there must be a national... Why am I asked, after I've talked about 60 years of a messed up relationship that has done nothing but destroy democratic forces in Pakistan, why am I asked to talk about whether there is actually a national security threat coming out of Pakistan? There is a national security threat coming out of Pakistan. It's aimed at the Pakistani people, whether we're talking about the US or talking about the Pakistani state. Okay? And then, of course, there is instantly there's this thing, yes, well, there's a lot of emotion in the relationship. I'm not interested in the emotion in the relationship between the Pakistani state and the US state. These are emotional issues because these are ethical issues. These are people's lives at stake. These are people's, not just one person's life and one family's life. We are talking about generations that are going to get messed up. How is this mess going to get cleaned up? We have not even dealt with the mess that the 1980s produced in Pakistan and Afghanistan, right?
And I'd like to, I wanted to talk about the emotion as well. I think there's actually not enough emotion from the part of the victims. I'm actually outraged that there isn't because, you know, I happened to be here on September 11th, and it's been how many years? 12 years. I'm really
12,
bad at math.
Yeah, 12.
12 years since September 11th, and every September 11th, I've been watching, you know, I've been riveted to the same Discovery Channel documentary, on the attacks and how they unfolded, it's a really well done piece of work. And then they go telling the story of each victim, you know, from the wife to the child to the mother. And there's one that I watch every year in which, you know, she talks about, it's the widow of a fireman. And she's watching the first tower come down and her husband's in the second tower. And she's waiting for it to come down and she can't stand it anymore. She's watching it with her child. You know, she goes in to take a shower. And as she's taking a shower, you know, she's left the door open so she can hear. And she hears that the second tower has come down. And at that point, she's wearing this necklace with her husband's picture in it, which falls, and she knew her husband had died. Incredibly powerful stuff, you know? Incredibly tragic stuff. Where is that about our drone victims? Where is that about the families of people that have been in prison in Bagram for years? And, you know, we need to be telling those stories. You know, where is that music, and where is that outrage, and where is that victimhood of what has happened to these guys and their families for the last 10, 11, 12 years? I would love, you know, not to berate in any way the violence that took place here. It is abhorrent in every way. And it takes years for a nation to heal that. But what about the violence that's been unleashed in Pakistan? You know, where is the story of the drone child, you know, who can't go to school because of the constant noise that is there while he's sleeping, while he's, you know, doing anything, and how he's terrorized by it? Where is the story of this, you know, woman who's in her hut, like, you know, waiting for her husband, and she sees, you know, a missile come down and devastate her family, and maybe her dupatta falls off, you know, and she knows that her husband has died? Where are those stories? Why aren't they being told?
And can I also just address, since I don't know when I'll get the floor again, let me just address a couple of other things.
And then we'll open it up for questions.
Sure. But I want to challenge this idea that somehow, well, I'll just have to take your word for the fact that I'm sure there are internal discussions about all these things, but as I think Sarah and Asim were pointing out, you know, I'm not sure that I believe that those discussions have anything to do with thinking about the victims of these policies and these programs, right? They may be, they're all kinds of, we get those kinds of arguments in the mainstream press when it's supposedly about talking about drone strikes. It's all coded in the sense of, you know, this algebra, right? Or the calculus, rather, of like, so does it make more sense to do, you know, is it cheaper? Is that why we're doing drones? Or is that the sort of conversation we should be having about drones? Is it just, you know, politically easier because, you know, you don't have boots on the ground? So it's those conversations, right? Those kinds of conversations.
And the legal framework.
And the legal framework. Is it legal, right? Is it legal according to US law? Is it legal according to international law? As if the law, I mean, the fetishization of the law really around all of this has just been incredible. As if the law is something that is magical, right? That just, it comes out of like, you know, some like godly thing. It is, it's clean and pure and good, right? As opposed to being something that is deeply political, right? And that it can change, right? It's things that are not legal can become legal, right? And anyway, so there's that. And so I wanted to challenge this idea that the conversation around drones in the mainstream conversation started to happen in the public sphere in the U.S. because the somehow these people inside the U.S. state machinery decided it was time. No, it started to happen because people broke the news, because there were reports that could not be ignored. Because brave, there were some brave, you know, places like The Guardian, thank God for The Guardian, you know, that relentlessly kept putting this stuff out because U.S. media wouldn't do it. And then when the issue became so big that the U.S. media couldn't ignore it, then suddenly you start seeing stories in the New York Times. But please notice, please, you know, if you haven't already noticed, please start noticing the way in which all these stories are framed. Because it's all about framing. So there's, you know, there's many different ways for those of you who are, you know, are professional or amateur media critics, and we should all be, as I think, informed citizens. There, you know, but mostly two main ways. There's the stories that are told, and therefore, by implication, the stories that are not told, and then how the stories that are told are framed. Yeah. Right? And I've actually had to deal with journalists who have been very well-meaning journalists. This fellow came after, this is after the emergency, or during the emergency, this was after Benazir was assassinated. So he came, he was an American correspondent for one of the big newspapers, I forget which, but something like the Washington Post or something like that. And he asked me, I spent actually a lot of time talking to him because I was so invested in making sure that the usual kinds of narratives about Pakistan don't appear. If he's listening to me, then I want to, you know, I know I don't have any control over the story, but at least I want him to, you know, hear me. And he seemed incredibly, you know, sincere, and I think he was. And of course, he wouldn't show me the final copy before it went out, but he showed me like an early draft, and I caught some things, you know, so I could. The story opens with an azan, but it's very sinister, right? And you're like, why does every story of Pakistan, you know, have to open with, like, azans, you know? Yes, they are part of everyday life, but they're a very ordinary part of everyday life. But, you know, in a story in the U.S. media about Pakistan, they stand out. Like, you know, this is a country that is, like, obsessed with, like, Islam, which is automatically this crazy religion, right? Anyway, so I told him, you know, well, I wouldn't do that because of this, because he had no idea. He had no idea that this is what people could read in this, right? He's like, but I heard the azan. And I was like, yes, you hear it five times a day, you know? And so I was like, just, you know, if you could just not mention that or start with that, right? And he's like, okay, you know. And then I saw the story once it came out, and there was the azan. And there was, you know, the story about Benazir, and so he was talking to all these women, you know, who had been touched in some way by her life and her death. And it's like incredible. Nothing in what they were saying had anything to do with religion and Islam, and yet it snuck in his, like, commentary. You know, it was all about how incredible it was that in an Islamic country you had this, you know, woman and etc. So, you know, there's the whole media kind of campaign. And I wanted to also sort of touch upon very quickly in my 1 minute about this issue of, like, you know, the Pakistani diaspora again being strange and schizophrenic because it doesn't speak in one voice. Well, I challenge you to find me any diaspora that speaks in one voice. Because guess what? The Pakistani diaspora is not born of whole cloth, right? So who is it that we are asking to approach the U.S. state or these U.S. media houses to tell the story properly? Are we asking the people whose sons are under special administrative measures in federal prisons? They tried, believe me. Faisal Hashmi's parents tried incredibly hard to have their story heard. The New York Times, even their metro editor didn't want to touch that story or write about it. You know?
Okay, I'm going to open it up for questions, but I will just say that I know on the drone thing, just to respond, that I do know those conversations were happening because I was in them. We can talk about it more later if you like. But
I'm not interested in what was happening inside the U.S. state.
I would just like to finish my thought. Mm-hmm. It's part of the conversation. It's part of the whole story. It's not the part of the story that you all are talking about, but I think that they're connected, and that's why I brought it up, because I wanted to refer back to what was happening in the United States in that policy community. Okay, questions. Why don't we take maybe a few questions at one time? Is that good? Because we have a few minutes left, so.
Please line up behind the mic. If you have a question, please identify yourself, and please make your question short, and if possible, make it a question.
Thanks, Steve. Sanjay Patil with the Public Health Program here at OSF. So being a Canadian, having worked on the Commission of Inquiry into Meher Arar, I have a lot of sympathy for the work that you guys have been doing with respect to rendition and the devastating consequences that flow from rendition. But what I wanted to ask about was sort of what was touched upon to some extent but not fully is the way forward. So we got a very good understanding, I feel, of the impact that the U.S. and the Pakistan state have both respectively had on the kind of rendition policies that you've been talking about. But I think one of the facts that wasn't really spoken about much that we can't sort of deviate too much from is the fact that thousands of people within Pakistan have died as a result of terror-related acts. And so we have, on the one hand, the Imran Khan school of thought on what should be done. On the other hand, we have what we've seen over the past 12 years being done. Hopefully, the three of you, four of you, have some ideas that fall somewhere in between in the spectrum of rationality that we could talk about in terms of a way forward, because I find that the two camps that we've seen play out in the discourse haven't necessarily spoken to the root causes for why things are happening in the way that they're happening and the way forward. So if you guys could talk about that, that would be appreciated.
No, I thought we were taking a few questions at a time.
There's only one.
Okay. Oh,
people are scared.
Well, there's another.
Oh, good.
Hi, John Neffel. I'm a journalist. Two quick questions. If the U.S. government continues to hold detainees at Bagram following the drawdown, does JPP have different, does that change what JPP can do, either in the court of law or the court of public opinion? And a second quick question, in terms of U.S.-Pakistan relationships, Mark Mazzetti reported on the drone program in Pakistan sort of beginning with what some called a bargain chip killing. Sort of tit for tat, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. And I was wondering if there are other examples of that kind of back and forth that have not received that same kind of attention.
I think getting into root causes begs the question of what is the problem that we're trying to get to the root cause of, right? And I think that's sometimes the disconnect that at least I have faced when we're having conversations about the war. For me, the problem is the U.S. militarization across the world, but particularly in my region, right? And not just, again, last 10 years or so, but the long history of it, which really, if we're looking for root causes, really we're talking about, or if you're talking very specifically about the root cause of this, you know, this national security threat, Al-Qaeda, or, Lashkar-e-Tayyiba, or the Taliban, or whoever the militant du jour is, the root cause of that really is the U.S.'s proxy war in Pakistan in the 1980s, right? Now, what are you going to do about that? And that, you know, of course, then instantly it sounds like I'm saying, well, it's just the U.S. I mean, it's never that simple. Nobody's ever saying that. But if that war had not happened, the course of his world history, I can promise you, would be very different. Okay, counterfactual. We can all play with counterfactuals. But that's what happens when you're sort of looking for root causes, unless you're looking for a root cause that was like maybe 5 years ago or something, and then you can say, okay, now we can tinker with this and fix it. But these kinds of things have such huge consequences that, you know, once you make a mess like this, it's really hard to figure out how to clean it up. What I can tell you is that what doesn't help is to have a war like this, is to have a war that devastates lives, that creates anger, that moves the society further right, which is what has happened. And these thousands of people that have died in terrorist attacks in Pakistan have also died in the last 12 years.
Sorry, before the others respond to that, I think the problem... I think the problem I have with that analysis is that it locates the violence in Pakistan strictly to the war on terror. I mean, the truth is that violence in Pakistan is not specific only to the war on terror or even to the war, the invasion, and the subsequent support for jihad in the 80s. I mean, if you look back, I mean, violence has been endemic to the region for a very long time. And if you look at, like, the militancy with the borders along India or prior to that, like, the problem I have is the simplistic reduction of violence in Pakistan strictly to the war on terror, which is why when we talk about a way forward, we do have to think about more than just the war on terror. And there was a question earlier posed about, you know, disappearances in the Pakistani state are not specific just to the war on terror. So if you look at the institutions, when you look at governance, when you look at all of these issues, it's not specific to, you know, history didn't begin in 1980, is my point. And so if we...
It began in 1954.
Can I just make one quick comment on this? I mean, just my two take points on the way forward is, and I've already said one of them is... you know, for this relationship to actually address some of these issues, which they both have their own stakes in, the United States and Pakistan, they are going to have some kind of, and the recommendations address this, some kind of public acknowledgement of what both sides are willing to do and say it actually publicly, right, and get something on paper. There have to be terms of engagement. There have to be, I don't know if you want to call it an MOU, you want to call it a treaty, you call it an accord, and then you have, you know, systematic engagements with the other side. I think your report recommended every 3 months or whatever. That has to be in place. But for years now, we haven't had the personnel relationships on both sides that were strong enough to even do that because we had these Raymond Davises and the Bin Laden raids and setting everything off track every once in a while. So that's my one point on the way forward there. And I think that, you know, Sara mentioned this on the need for... actually, maybe you didn't. You might have disagreed with it, but the counterterrorism legislation—you know—it's kind of working against what your interests. But if you can take that kind of negative space that's been created and, you know, co-opt it and work it through legal channels, I think that's kind of another way forward. That's middle of the ground, and that's another area where two countries can work together. And that's a very optimistic analysis. I mean, I'm not saying that that's within the realm of possibility, but I actually do think the legal approach is probably the only way that these two extreme sides can meet somewhere and move forward. So, sorry.
Thank you, Shimon. I want to look at the way you asked that question. I'm just intrigued by the way you used the word violence in such a sweeping way to not be able to differentiate violence in Pakistan. Well, that's one thing. Secondly, you know, there's a lot of violence in India, there's a lot of violence in Sri Lanka, and yet no one frames the issues in those countries starting from the violence. So when you talk about, you know, what to do with the violence that has affected Pakistanis, so we will now talk about specifically the violence as a result of the policies of the state of Pakistan post 9/11. A lot of that violence is in reaction to military activities, for example, that have taken place in Balochistan and in Fatah, for example, right? So this is not violence emerging out of some...
Let's just
talk about the regions that are obvious. So I have been in Banawaziristan and right after 9/11, covering the region 2000-2003, and have seen entire villages being cleansed. I have seen helicopter gunships firing into civilian populations. I've seen what the Baasan military has done in Fatah. And it was 4 or 5 years after which the suicide bomb attacks begin in Peshawar and Lahore. So there's a trajectory to certain kinds of violence. And by the way, the people from Fatah, the so-called Taliban, were always very clear about what they were reacting to. We may not believe them, what have you, but there are trajectories to certain violence. You're absolutely right that disappearances were happening before, but the state policies were also happening before. We can't forget 1971 Bangladesh. We cannot forget the military campaigns in Balochistan that followed. We have a state that has a deeply troubled, if not completely colonial, relationship to the majority of its citizens and performs immense amount of violence against its citizenry. So you have institutional structures of violence that are in play, that, of course, get exacerbated when you have, say, an Afghanistan invasion happening next door. It sort of resonates with this national security state. They jump right into it. They're having a field day, by the way, right now in Balochistan. And you hear a lot about this anti-Hazara violence or what have you. This is part and parcel of a violence that has been unleashed on Balochistan, which we'd never hear about. So you get one side of the picture, but you don't hear about what the state has been doing. So they are, you know, they are clearly reactions related to policies in Afghanistan, the American presence there, what is happening in Fatah. But yes, you're right. There are other, you know, disappearances and so on, things which have other reasons, which are, say, more domestic or more related to what the state's trying to do, you know, within itself, outside of the rubric of. I mean, the Pakistani military has its own goals within Pakistan, not the least of which is to maintain its economic and political control over the state. It's one of the principal prisms in which you should try and start to understand Pakistan as well. I think that's one of Saadia's and Aisha Siddiqa's main arguments in their work over the last 8-9 years. I mean, this military sort of stands apart. It reminds me of what Arundhati Roy pointed out when she spoke about the Indian middle class. The Indian middle class has seceded from India. They've sort of run off somewhere else. Well, the Pakistani military, never became Pakistani. They're sort of running a parallel state, and they see it as that. And, it's an incredibly violent and distancing and sort of a colonial settler kind of mentality. So
can I address the first question that the gentleman asked?
Yes, and
never,
and
your
then
question
I want
got lost.
To let Fawzia ask a question as well, but please go ahead.
I think that's a really good question, and it's something that we've been asking in all our meetings with government officials. What is your plan post 2014? What is that going to look like? And we constantly highlight for them that the issue of Bagram and the United States possibly continuing to hold non-Afghan nationals on Afghan soils post, the 2014 handover is really going to go to the crux of what the United States presence will look like in Afghanistan after the drawdown. And we've tried to say, and this is why the name of the report is that, we draw parallels between what the United States is facing right now in terms of a PR nightmare with Guantanamo yet again, with people being force-fed, and on hunger strike, that you're going to see the same, with Bagram. In fact, there have been hunger strikes already. But it's just not tenable. And that's why, this report is quite timely, because it's an effort to really say to both governments that you're staring at another Gitmo PR nightmare in the face. You want to solve it now, and it can be solved. We have heard different things from the administration about, what they plan on doing to these guys. They don't have what's really disheartening after, speaking to them over a year and a half, 2 years, is that they still don't have a plan. They don't have a clear policy, and they don't have a plan. And it's incredible to me that you wouldn't learn from the mistakes of the past and try to be proactive about it. I always thought that my government was one of the laziest in terms of being proactive, when it came to standing up for the rights of its own citizens. But my goodness, has the United States government, which is also my government, have you not realized? You didn't get it right with Guantanamo. Please, learn from that. And I don't see that political will or that incentive to actually solve this problem either. But I can tell you what JPP intends on doing, if they still stay there. I think, there's only a couple of options. You hand them over to the Afghans. That's going to be a nightmare for the U.S. because, Pakistanis as prisoners in Afghanistan are one of the most vulnerable group of people that you could have. There is a lot of mistrust and antagonism between the Afghans and the Pakistanis. I've been to Kabul many times. And I've actually been to, I'm not allowed to go to Bagram, but I've been to the regular prisons around Kabul, and I've met with Pakistani prisoners there. And, their lot is just 1,000 times worse. Now, throw in the fact that you have, UN and Open Society and other, reports that detail the level of torture that's inflicted under the Afghan regime on its detainees, the United States is leaving itself open to severe allegations of torture. So they're going to be handing them over to the Pakistani detainees in a very risky situation. Fly them back to the United States. I don't think you guys are very, there's been much success with that either. Can't fly them into Gitmo either. You know, I don't think Obama would like that or want that. There'd be some more hunger strikers with tubes down their nose, and they might have access to legal representation. So why would you do that? I wish I knew what they were going to do. I wish they had a policy. They knew exactly what they were going to do. But we're keeping a very close eye on it, and we intend to follow it through. And also, the other option is transfer them to Pakistan to be tried, not have them whisked away under these WACP regulations to far-off areas where, you know, again, it's another internment regime. So we intend to fight those as well if that's what happens.
Okay. Fawzia, please.
Because Shamila has not been provocative enough, let me try to pick up where she might have failed. None of you mentioned the word Saudi Arabia. I understand what this panel is about, but I'd like you to address what I, in my estimation, is right now an actor that is far more potent and lethal and important and financially involved in Pakistan and what is happening than the United States, which looks like a schoolyard bully compared to them. I would also like to really push on, I don't want to play the numbers game, but I'm about to arrive at the age of 50, and so I have lived through many years of Pakistan's violence, as Sanjay puts it. And you know, those holding the guns and shooting and killing and whipping and beheading happen to be Pakistanis. And so I'd like you to also address a little bit about the victims of sectarian killings, victims who are from the Ahmadi community, the Christians, the Hindus who are fleeing because their women are being kidnapped and raped and et cetera, and all of that, because I think that Shamila asked a very important question, which is, and I'm going to ask it in another way, Shamila, which is, I'd like you also to tell me what has gone wrong with our homeland and two generations of people who do have a huge ambivalence towards what is terrorism, what is right, what is wrong, and what has gone on. And so please do address what is the threat coming out of Pakistan, number one for Pakistan, from Pakistanis, all of us complicit in that, and what is the threat to the world should we not be able to get this figured out?
Before you do launch into this, I can sense the tension. I would actually, I can tell you, as before I started doing the JPP, I worked as a criminal lawyer, and you really get a very good idea of the kind of violence, Pakistani on Pakistani violence that's being committed, because you see it played out in the criminal courts. what I can tell you is that when you have, drawing on what Asim said, when you have a police force or institutions that are perhaps colonial legacies, that are structurally there to perpetuate a level of violence on its citizens, I have seen that violence get internalized by Pakistanis and perpetrated on others. I would say that that's what's happening with our society. When you see, and this is an argument we make in court against the government all the time, that when you see the state perpetuate that violence on its own citizens and not respect their lives or their rights, then you see the citizens absorb that level of violence. What I see when I moved to Pakistan, after finishing my law degree, after leaving during the Zia years, when I was taken aback by how brutal and violent the state had become, but at the same time, I could see why society had reacted that way. Because I saw, for example, JPP also works on defending victims of torture by the police torture, because that's a whole other project on its own. It's endemic, it's systematic, and when you see what's perpetuated on the lives of these communities on an everyday level, that you can understand that why, at what point does that dehumanization become just, internalized and the citizens start wrecking it on each other. I don't believe we're a particularly violent society. I think we have learned from years and years of violence being, inflicted on us to really stop valuing each other's lives either. So I won't deny that we're a violent society now. I don't think we're more violent than other societies, but I think there's a history and a context to that violence. And to just come out and say that we are people who flog women in the streets or any of that, I think that presents a very myopic view of where that violence comes from and why it's being perpetuated. Sorry. Now, feel free to go.
No, I mean, I think, again, it's just wonderful. You know, I tried, and obviously in 5 to 10 minutes, I obviously failed to do justice to what is an incredibly complex history. But, you know, I'm a social scientist and a historical sociologist in particular. So I do think structurally and historically. And so that's one thing. So I did try to kind of show that what is going on today, however we want to slice that question of what the problem is, right, has a history and a logic to it, right? But we can go over that as well. But I find it fascinating that, again, what is it that this event was supposed to be about? Somehow we have, as usual, come down to talking about what is wrong with Pakistan and what is wrong with Pakistanis. Well, number one, long history of having this kind of constant militarization from abroad and locally. I mean, I challenge you to find me any society that is going to be able to deal with that. You were speaking, Shamila, about Indonesia. Have you people had a chance to see the act of killing? My God, I could not sleep that night. Do not watch it at night, first of all. It was the most horrifying, like the banality of evil, really. And you know, then you can ask the question, what is wrong with Indonesians? Well, let me remind you about the Cold War. And I'm sorry, and I know it always sounds like I think that I want to hold the US responsible for everything, but it is a superpower. It did set the terms. It did define a lot of how the world functions today, and it continues to. So I'm sorry if I'm sitting in New York City talking to you and wanting to talk specifically about something that doesn't get talked about, which is US complicity in the violence in particular places. And I want to keep challenging the fact that every time we talk about that, this gets turned on to, yes, but there is obviously something wrong with Pakistan too. Well, and so again, let me say, yes, there is something wrong in Pakistan. That is connected. I mean, first of all, it's no different from any other society. Any other society under these kinds of conditions, historical and otherwise, would produce the same result. Right?
I mean,
and then you need to, and it would not, these conditions that we are talking about have everything to do with how the US has functioned in the world.
And it's not, I'm sorry, I mean, as a criminal lawyer, I would say, I mean, I look at the US correction system, and you guys have the highest rate. You're number one in the number of people that you incarcerate. You know, I look at the level of gun violence here. You know, massacres of, you know, shooting children and, you know, in kindergarten and all of that. So, you know, and there's actually an index now. I wish I'd looked that up now. It's been a while. But there's an index of how violent the country is in terms of, like, murder rate. Pakistan's, like, somewhere in the 70s, you know. I think we just beat the United Kingdom and stuff. We're not really that high up in terms of violence. So, you know, I go to that. Like, why is it always about...
Do you have any final words?
Yeah, I just want to make, like, a couple of...
Answer my question. Yeah, answer the question, and
so,
then we'll...
But, I mean, your questions are very difficult ones, right? So I can't pretend to answer them. I'll just make a few points. So you mentioned the sectarian violence against minorities, and part of my work was in Quetta, where the Hazara Shia community was facing a very difficult sort of assault, particularly in the city itself. I think that we, and I want to differentiate, I think it's important to look at each community in terms of the context of where they belong and where these things are happening. So, for example, the Ahmadiyya, one of the earliest, discrimination and attacks against them, you know, takes us back to 1953 in Pakistan, when we were still a liberal, modern state, and it was concocted by a liberal, middle-class, modern Pakistani political movement. So, from a very early age, they were used as pawns in a political game, and that has continued. The Hazara Shia context, which was always posed as a genocide or sectarian, cannot, of course, be understood decontextualized from the violence that is happening in Balochistan and the religious groups that have been unleashed there to undermine the Balochi nationalist movement. So it's very hard to separate these what happened to the Hazara and claim that it's purely because they were Shia. I think that there are these other factors because, what's the group called that's working? The Lashkar-e-Jangvi has very close relationships with the Pakistani military establishment, and they were invited into Balochistan to undermine these very powerful nationalist movement that they continue to do so. And Lashkar-e-Jangvi has its own agenda, which is anti-Shia. And so they're having a bit of party and having fun, and this is part of this trying to posit Balochistan as a sectarian issue as opposed to one has to argue that it is actually, sort of a... So I know I'm not answering your question, but I think that time and geography should help us understand why something is happening. We had the Shia killings in Karachi in the 1990s, which were at an extreme, but that's different from the Shia killings in Quetta in 2000. I think that's my point on that question. So, and we have a very interesting, and by the way, and Hindus, that's, I think it's a little bit different because that's tied into Pakistani nationalism and it's tied into the antagonisms of post-partition and how we see that. And, they do actually live a very deeply discriminated life in Pakistan, but the Hazara Shia are actually of some of the more successful communities in Pakistan. They're deep, they're important members of our military establishment. They've been more important members of the federal government. So many military heroes. Even the Hazara themselves, their own narratives about Pakistan are very nationalistic, as opposed to a Hindu who, of course, from day one is seen to be alien and bizarre and not belonging because of. So I think that that's a good question, but I think it's again it goes back to context of geography and time, which is part of what we're trying to help people see Pakistan, not as a universal pathology, but to study it and see it as a, as a secular, worldly issue that needs to be understood from when something happened and what's being exploited to, bring this violence. Saudi Arabia is a tricky one. I thought Saudi is in a better position to talk about it. I know that Muniza has some, and I have had many discussions about, who's Fawzia's sister, by the way. I've had many discussions about Saudi Arabia's role, and you're right. So I'm just going to quickly close. Sorry. So I think one of the things that throughout this conversation that we always did is us versus them, right? And I would just want to point out there is no us and there's no them. So this why do they hate us thing was the first gambit of this rather false dichotomy that has been set up. But we have interests and communities in Pakistan that are completely aligned with segments of America's neoconservative community, for example. And in very powerful position in Pakistan. And so they're more than happy to be a part of, whether it's drone programs or detentions or any neoconservative ideas about redrawing the Middle East or South Asia, whatever. There are resonances. I think that we cannot do these geographical separations that it's America versus Pakistan. I think our challenge is more on sort of perspectives, attitudes, approaches to issues, and how we address issues of justice and rights as opposed to, communities. Okay, this is America's problem, this is Pakistan. Because there's a lot of collusion. There's a lot of, benefit that Pakistanis gain from these wars and from these, the presence of all this money sloshing around. There's tens of billions, lots of it coming from Saudi Arabia, that, warrants our BMW dealerships all over the country. I mean, we don't really have industry, but we have lots and lots of high-end consumer products that I don't know where they came from. But.
And we are out of time. I would like to thank the panelists for their insights and bringing these photographs here and introducing this narrative that is very much not evaluated and essentially absent in the policy debate here in the States and especially in Washington. So thank you, and thank you for the great questions.
Thank you for your patience.
Thank you.